Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I'm John Batchelor with Danielle Claude. Her book is A Future in Flames, the story of bushfires in Australia, but the story of bushfires everywhere if you consider the threat to arable land, to people, to wildlife, to ecosystems, and yet not a threat because it, as we've established, it is part of a continent, a part of nature. We come now to the question of what burns. In my conversation with you about the koala, I learned that eucalyptus is a torch when it's hit by fire because of the eucalyptus oil and burns very quickly and then blows through. There's another tree that also you write about, the mountain ash, and that tree, the ash forests of Australia, both the eucalyptus and the mountain ash regenerate very quickly. Is that correct, Danielle?
Yeah, so mountain ash is a eucalypt as well. It's actually the largest of all the eucalypts and the largest hardwood in the world. It's as tall, if not possibly taller, in the past than the redwoods, California, and the eucalypts are what we call a fire adapted group of plants. So they're drought adapted, and those drought adaptations happen to have made them resilient in the face of fire. So they regenerate after fire. There's a lot of deaths, but there's also majority usually survive fires. Mountain ash has an interesting history because it actually does die after fire, but it releases a huge load of seed into the forest and it needs a lot of sun to regenerate. So in the aftermath of a fierce fire, a very, very fierce fire, and mountain ash fires are notoriously fierce. They only happen every 200 or 300 years naturally. And the forests burn really fiercely, and then the cleared areas are just reseeded with all these mountain ash. So mountain ash all grow at the same rate and all together. So they're same stand forests, which makes them really spectacular, but also extremely terrifying when they actually burn because it's incredibly fierce.
The start of fires. There's lightning, which is an explanation for the early tens of thousands of years of Australia. There are power lines and there's arson. I was shocked to learn in your reporting that 50% of your fires are arson. Purposeful arson, meaning to kill people, arson?
No, look, arson's a really complicated issue. I'm not sure of the exact figures at the moment about how frequent, but they are frequently lit, but they're very often less dangerous than some of the other fires, lightning fires and electrical faults and those sorts of things, mostly because they're sometimes they're lit for attention. You know, people want to see the fire trucks come out, so they light them somewhere where they're going to be seen, where the fires are going to be seen easily. So they're not, I don't know how often they would be lit to harm people. I think it's more people who have a psychological issue with fire and fire trucks and things like that.
I also need to attend to the fuel. We've mentioned the eucalyptus, but it's the undergrowth. That's the story in the west of the United States, and your undergrowth has a mixed record. You talk about weeds, but it's particular kinds of weeds. There's one weed, I have it in my notes, it doesn't come to me at hand, that is supposed to be fireproof, but you find that it burns very quickly.
Well, this is one of the interesting things about preparing for fires is everything burns ultimately. You know, it just has to have the right conditions to burn. Even you know, steel and things like that will combust at some point. But it has to be, you know, it's what burns easily or not. So under some conditions, some bushes, if they've got lots of water, if their leaves are nice and succulent, then they are harder to burn. But ultimately, they will. You can make most things burn if you try hard enough. So I think that's the issue we need to look at. We need to look at the particular conditions the species are under and whether they burn. And things that grow on one side of the country might not burn very well, but things that grow here do burn more because it's drier or the conditions are drier. So it's really a very personal voyage to work out what makes your property safer.
Yes, I have. I found the list here. You have blackberries, Spanish heath, wattles, and the burning weed that's not supposed to burn is pitosporums.
Yes, pitosporum. Yes, but again, it's a complicated thing because if you have a pitosporum hedge that's well watered, it will actually protect your home from ember attack. So, you know, the embers might drop into the, but if it's nice and damp, then it works like a sponge. But if your pitosporums get hot enough, then potentially they can go up quite fast. And also there's lots of different species, so it probably differs by species as well.
H.G. Wells has a quote in Daniel's book that I enjoyed a great deal. The heart of it is, fire is not an invader. It's a gorilla, and it's very opportunistic with those sparks flying. And the response in Australia eventually was the very famous fire brigades, and we have a moment here to praise them. Fire brigades started with insurance companies, I'm following Daniel's reporting, in the late 19th century, but it was a 1939 big fire that got everybody launched. And Danielle, I'm impressed how much of the fire brigades are volunteers, not paid people at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so insurance companies were the ones who started the township brigades. So they're particularly interested in protecting buildings, but that kind of left the country areas unprotected, the farmers and the people who lived in the bush. So rural communities established their own parallel brigades. So we have town metropolitan fire brigades and we have bush fire brigades. So the bush fire brigades were started by volunteers themselves, and they started in, the first one was 1901, a small town called Berrigan in the Riverland near the River Murray, after some major fires and also the Federation drought, which in Australia was a really, really terrible drought. So people were very worried about fire. So they banded together and organised themselves, and that was a model that rolled out across many rural communities. But after the 1939 fires in Victoria, which were enormous, government stepped in and started funding those brigades and organising a state body that could manage them and oversee them and support them, and that's continued ever since.
All right, let's talk about what you can do for yourself, because Australia is pragmatic and inventive. Daniel Claude, the book is A Future in Flames. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.